This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. In Baghdad today, closing arguments in the case of four U.S. soldiers. They're accused of raping a young Iraqi girl, then killing her and her family. It is just the latest alleged atrocity committed by American service members in Iraq. In another case, U.S. Marines are accused of killing 24 civilians, including 10 women and children, in the Iraqi town of Haditha last year. In Vietnam, the massacre at My Lai is really the only such incident most of us know about. But the Los Angeles Times went over thousands of pages of declassified documents from the Vietnam War and found that there were many more atrocities in that war and that many of them went unpunished. This hour, why do these things happen in war and what can be done to prevent them? Later in the program, Joe Lieberman loses in Connecticut and Cynthia McKinney comes up short in Georgia. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us for his weekly visit. And you can email your questions for Ken now to talk@npr.org. But first, war and atrocities. What lessons can be learned from the horrors of war? Do military policies need to be changed? What causes some to go over the line while others don't? We want to hear your thoughts. We'd particularly like to hear from those of you who've served in combat. What was your experience like? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And joining us here today in Studio 3A is Deborah Nelson. She's an investigative reporter at the Los Angeles Times and co-wrote the story about the higher number of Vietnam atrocities that appeared in last Sunday's paper. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your reporting is based on records of a Vietnam War crime investigative group. So first of all, can you tell us about the work of this group? Who is this group? What were they about?
This group was in the Chief of Staff's office of the Army and in the personnel office. After My Lai, General Westmoreland became chief of staff for the Army. And he his office assembled a group of staffers, this kind of ad hoc group, not even a they didn't really work as a committee, to keep tabs on other allegations of war crimes. And what they did was collect and make summaries of war crimes that were being investigated by the Criminal Investigation Division. They generated reports, wrote memoranda that went up the chain of command.
And these records have been in an archive at the University of Maryland, but they were declassified in 1994. So why are we hearing about them now? Just based on your reporting, or
they are? They actually are at the National Archives, which is in College Park, Maryland. They were declassified in 1994 as required, but nobody really took notice of them. I think I know that the reporters who worked on the Tiger Force looked at some of them a few years ago. But here's how we found out about them. My partner, Nicholas Terse, was working on a dissertation at Columbia University. And he was looking at some military issues. And somebody he ran into at the archives said there's this incredible collection of declassified records that's been sitting around for some years and nobody's taken a look at it. You ought to take a look. He took a look and immediately changed the subject of his dissertation, went through the 9,000 pages of records, and then came to the Los Angeles Times and said, I think we've got a story here. Would you be interested?
Yeah. Now, one of the most chilling and detailed stories that you tell is about a massacre of 19 civilians, which apparently was witnessed by a number of servicemen and even reported to the military in the 1970s. Maybe you can tell us first what happened. What was that story?
Well, in those records were 320 substantiated incidents. These are incidents that were war crimes reports that were substantiated by the Army's own investigators. And among those reports was the story of James Henry. He had served in Vietnam in 67 and 68 in Quang Nam province. And he witnessed a series of murders by members of his company. And then he also witnessed the massacre of 19 civilians. He was told at the time that if he reported any of the things that he saw wrong, that he wouldn't end up going home. This is a common sentiment expressed by soldiers that we talk to, veterans that we talk to, that they were really afraid of getting shot in the back if they reported what they saw. And he was kind of set straight from the moment he got to Vietnam on that issue. When he got back home, he felt it was safe to report. He tried to report to the Criminal Investigation Division. The investigator didn't believe him, asked him what he was trying to pull. So he went out and he left the service. And when he left the service, he held a press conference and published an article that laid out the massacre and the other murders that he saw. He also testified at what was called the Winter Soldier Investigation, where 100 soldiers stepped forward to talk about war crimes that they saw. They were immediately surrounded in controversy. The Nixon administration worked behind the scenes to discredit them. They were accused of being traitors and fabricators. And so Henry was part of that disbelieved crowd of veterans who tried to speak out about war crimes.
And it turned out that all along, that in the end, that this group of investigators were looking into his allegations and finding out that they were true.
After he had his press conference, they called him and talked to him. He talked to them twice. He never heard from them again. He had no idea that they had pursued this and talked to more than 100 members of his company until Nick and I showed up at his door last fall. They had no idea that they had substantiated, that they had confirmed his report, and that they had confirmed the massacre as well as the other murders. He didn't know, but the public didn't know either.
And even though his allegations were confirmed, nothing happened.
Nothing happened. None of the named subjects in the investigation were pursued at all. Some of them had already left the Army, and the Army was not pursuing ex-servicemen. Many soldiers who were named in these investigations had left the military and were not pursued because the administration really didn't. There wasn't a political will to do that. But the ones who were still in the service also were not prosecuted in any way.
Hmm. I think you quoted someone as saying, well, the war is almost, you know, the war is over or almost over. Let's just not go there. That was the sentiment.
Yeah, we heard that from every level, from the investigators to legal officers in the Army to the general counsel of the Army.
Well, was there a sense that this is what happens in war? And but what was the sense beyond saying the political will just wasn't there?
At that time, the war was starting to wind down. It was very unpopular. People just, I think as somebody said, people just wanted to put it behind them. They saw prosecution as just extending the war and the controversies. And they wanted to put those crimes behind them. They just wanted to get out of the war and forget about it.
Now, of those 300, I think it was 320 cases, mm-hmm. did you say?
Yes.
What was the follow-up? I mean, what happened to... They were confirmed. These were ones where incidents were, in fact, confirmed.
Were confirmed, yeah. We looked at, what happened to those cases in which civilians or prisoners, in which noncombatants were hurt or killed by soldiers, which are the most serious cases. And the records name 203 soldiers in those incidents. And we found that only 57 were court-martialed. And of those, just 23 were found guilty and 14 were sent to prison. More than half of them, nothing happened at all.
Well, now that this information is coming to light in this way, can anything happen now? Or what are you hearing? Are you getting reaction? Are you hearing that there's any of these cases are going to be pursued, or can they be pursued?
They probably could be pursued. That's not a decision for me to make. But one thing that surprised both of us when we were asking people, military officials from that era, what they did with these records. You know, did anybody sit down and beyond prosecuting people, did anybody sit down to look at what conditions, what deficiencies, what policies were leading to war crimes or were failing to prevent them? And nobody had taken a look. Here's this incredible collection of records, this incredible opportunity, you know, to analyze for lessons learned, and it was never done. And I think it's still relevant. I think there still are lessons to be learned from that, and that's what we're hearing from people, that exposing this might give, in fact, people are talking about what lessons can be learned and how it might be applied to the current situation in Iraq.
No. I want to ask Michael Sala to join the conversation now. He's joining us from member station WLRN in Miami. He's investigations editor for the Miami Herald and co-author of Tiger Force, A True Story of Men in War. That book chronicles the seven-month rampage through the central highlands of Vietnam by an elite platoon of soldiers known as Tiger Force. Michael Sala, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And I know, and I think Deborah mentioned earlier, that you have looked at some of these same documents that Deborah reported on. Is that right?
Yeah, we looked at the summaries of 240-plus cases that are in the National Archives to get a broad-based look at the types of allegations and war crime investigations that were taken place by the Working War Crimes Group, what they oversaw at that time. So it gave you a pretty good idea of what ultimately happened to these cases, and I think the statistics bear it out very closely that so many of them are now prost and put by the wayside. Some where probable cause, substantiation of a war crime is they develop enough to develop probable cause to charge a soldier. And in many cases, they charged him, but nothing ever happened.
Yeah. Now, since you've written your book, you've also been interviewing veterans from the Iraq War. What are you hearing there?
Well, the parallels are striking when you start to get into the levels of frustration that many of the troops are experienced in Vietnam and experienced in Iraq, particularly, you know, after a couple of years of conflict, where this is not lost on many of the men and women in Iraq and as well that were in Vietnam, that they are fighting a very frustrating war. It's counterinsurgency. You don't always know who the enemy is. And anger sets in, frustration set in, and the way the war is going, the way in which they can read the whether there is, quote, victory around the corner or light at the end of the tunnel, the troops know where they stand and how the conflict is going on. And that takes a very real role in their mindset and in their psychology when they're out there. And I'm hearing that both from Iraqi war veterans as well as from the Vietnam vets that we talk to.
We are talking about war atrocities and war. When we come back, what the military is doing to improve training. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about war and atrocities. In Iraq, U.S. servicemen faced charges including murder and rape. And a report in the Los Angeles Times uncovered even more chilling crimes that were committed during the war in Vietnam. Today, the lessons learned from previous atrocities and how to prevent them in the future. Our guests are Deborah Nelson. She's an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times. And Michael Sala, co-author of the book Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send an email to talk@npr.org. Michael Sala, I'm just wondering, based on your research into Vietnam, your experience now talking to soldiers in Iraq, do you have a sense that lessons have been learned?
That's a good question. I think that for some, I think that the problem you run into is that, like any breakdown of soldiers in war, the psychological, the mental, the spiritual breakdown of soldiers in war can happen in any war. What it really requires is a strong command element, usually a breakdown in infantrymen and people that are out in battle, and the killing of civilians, the crossing of the lines, really is indicative of a breakdown in leadership. And I think that the Army went to great lengths after Vietnam to try to incorporate some of the training that was necessary in distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants and what have you. But much is lost when you're over there. Much is lost in Iraq right now. And if you're listening to some of the soldiers, there was a very good piece in the Washington Post on July 27th about interviews with soldiers from the 1st Armored Division, the 6th Infantry, and the 2nd Battalion. The frustrations that they're facing over there are so similar to Vietnam. And without strong leadership, I think it can break down very quickly. And particularly if there's a culture where you have this degradation of the enemy, which it has to take place to some extent in war, and then the level of anger and frustration that's out there, where soldiers will, you know, as you in the case of Haditha and others, are bearing this out. There is an amount of civilians being targeted. It happens. It happens in war. The Army can train us to a certain extent, but it really starts with leadership. I think that it's difficult to know and to measure how much the military has done to try to prevent the kind of events that occurred in Vietnam.
All right. Let's take a call now from William, and he's calling from Zanesville, Ohio. Hi, William.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
You're present. That's good. I was I served in Quang Tri Province in Vietnam, and I was amazed by the depth and level and casual level of racism against the Vietnamese when I was there. And I see the same thing. Excuse me. Your previous guest just mentioned cultural insensitivity. I see the same thing in Iraq, and I hear the same thing when I listen to what soldiers say and the terms they use to describe Iraqis. You know, towel heads and Hajis and that sort of thing. Haji, by the way, of course, is a term of honor. But I am surprised that we have not equipped every one of our soldiers in Iraq with one of those little handheld speak and spell translators, which I think would do a world of good to make our troops more culturally sensitive and also more effective.
And was it your experience that kind of cultural sensitivity, insensitivity, and racism did in fact contribute to possible atrocities occurring?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, once you dehumanize somebody in the same way that that black folks got lynched because they were dehumanized, mm-hmm. You can do the same thing to other foreigners.
All right, William. Thanks for that. Thanks for that contribution, Deborah Nelson. Did you see that reflected in these reports? Did these reports address causation at all, or why these things may have occurred?
They didn't address causation. However, in reading the interviews, they contain the sworn statements of many soldiers who were interviewed, both the people who reported, the witnesses, as well as the shooters. We also talked to many of the veterans who were named in these, and that issue came up over and over and over again, that from basic training on, they were taught to not to think of Vietnamese as human beings. The other point that the caller made that I think is an important one that came up over and over again is their inability to understand Vietnamese. Mm. So intense situations where you're trying to decide if somebody is an enemy combatant or a civilian, and you're talking to them and telling them to stop, and they're afraid of you, you're holding a gun and they're running the other way, and you have to make a snap decision. You see that contributing to some of the civilian killings that occurred. There was no real attempt to bring in translators that we could tell in the records. In fact, that was a big complaint of many of the soldiers.
I'd like to bring retired Lieutenant Colonel Conrad Crane into the conversation now. The U.S. military is developing a new counterinsurgency manual, and Colonel Crane heads up that project. He's also director of the Army Military History Institute at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on your show.
Now, I know you've been listening to the conversation. How aware is the military leadership of the potential for these kinds of problems? How are they trying to address them?
Well, I think we have got to go back to the initial discussion of Vietnam. The researchers are right about the number of cases that were not prosecuted that they found, but in general within the military there was a sense that leadership had failed in Vietnam. And so there's in the 1970s and 1980s there's a complete revamping of leadership doctrine, especially in the Army, and it's continued to today. And in our project on the counterinsurgency manual includes a separate chapter on leadership and ethics in counterinsurgency that emphasizes the importance of maintaining ethical values, the responsibility of leaders to make sure their subordinates prepared for the pressures they're going to face. We actually address the point about frustration that was so clearly discussed earlier.
How do you get
frustration of your troops? Yeah, go ahead.
What is it? What do you recommend that military leaders do to address those kinds of problems?
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, you could go to there are health issues. We have some guidelines in there that about how you look for the signs of stress on your soldiers. You've got to manage the expectations of your soldiers, as well as the civilians, as well as the American public, as well as the international arena, about what's really going on. That was also addressed by, you know, soldiers that weren't quite sure how things were going. You've got to keep people informed and accurately up to date on what's going on. You've got to be honest with everybody about progress. You've got to deal very quickly with transgressions, and we emphasize that as also in there. And, you know, this is a type of warfare that thrives upon creating these kind of pressures on the counterinsurgent. I mean, that's insurgent tactics. Causing and exploiting atrocities has long been an insurgent tactic, and the information age technology increases its effects even more.
What about the concern that was just raised, what we just heard from the Vietnam veteran who said that there was incredible cultural insensitivity during Vietnam, racism, and that contributed to this? How is that different now?
That's another very astute observation. And again, it's another thing we address in the manual. One of our key principles for counterinsurgency is understanding the environment. We have two large sections about cultural intelligence, not only understanding your enemy, but also understanding the population that you're in. Everything from social structures to the way they eat to their religious beliefs, you've got to understand that. I remember hearing some of the Vietnam veterans talking about the fact that their whole cultural training on Vietnam was a 5-minute briefing on the boat as they went in. Today we have whole training programs where units are taken through programs on Iraqi culture. There are attempts to do a basic Arabic language training. If you go to the National Training Center and the different major training centers around the country, we're no longer these big force-on-force battles against the Russian hordes. They're now very complex situations where you have combat activities at the same time you're trying to do civil-military relations with a local village, trying to deal with the mayor's concerns about sewage treatment in his town, and also dealing with the hot dog vendor who's really a terrorist who's trying to slip a bomb into your mess hall. It's a very complex environment, and we try to prepare our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines as well as we can for what they're getting into. Language is also another key point that was brought up. We actually have an appendix in the manual about how to deal with interpreters. We're trying to increase language skills. Those are our key elements, and it is true that cultural desensitization, or whatever you want to call it, can lead to these problems.
All right, if you can stay on the line with us for a moment, I'd like to take a call from Josh in Stockton, California. Josh, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah,
hi. I'd like to thank the gentleman for pointing out earlier, you know, the conditions that soldiers actually undergo. I spent 12 years in Iraq, or I'm sorry, 12 months in Iraq, during March 26th of 03 to March 14th of 2004. And the conditions that you go through, you know, in combat are absolutely horrific, especially in this modern war. You know, my battle buddy was murdered in an IED, improvised explosive device, in Kirkuk City, about 12 feet from where I was standing, you know, out of a garbage can. You know, who would expect a garbage can, you know, to be used as some kind of weapon? And, you know, at every turn, you know, especially in urban combat, you have no idea, absolutely no idea who's going to be your enemy. You know, there was a 14-year-old child who threw a grenade in our bunker, and luckily the grenade was a dud, or else I wouldn't be talking to you here today.
All right, Josh.
You know, there is many, many stresses in combat that, you know, that the modern soldier undergoes. And I just was wondering, you know, if they're doing any research right now for, you know, pre-surveys for the actual soldiers were civilians, when they were civilians, how they act as opposed to after going through an intense, you know, stressful situation like that.
All right, Judge, I'm going to turn to Lieutenant Colonel Conrad Crane to respond to some of what you're saying about the conditions he's describing. And also, let's make it clear, and I think Josh would probably agree with this, that Well, understanding how much stress and how difficult any military situation is, the standard, the military standard is, it is not an excuse for committing an atrocity. Lieutenant Colonel?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that goes back to the importance of leadership we've already talked about. There are considerable studies being done about the effect of stress on soldiers as they come out of combat. A lot of these are legacies of Vietnam, and there's a lot of studies being done on Iraq today. And then there are results. I've seen some articles on some of the results. There's a significant impact on the soldiers. The military has a number of programs to decompress and to relieve soldiers of some of that stress and to deal with it. Again, we even talk about it to some extent in our manual. The caller did a very good job describing some of the intense conditions that our service people undergo. And to be honest, we should be very proud of the performance of 99% of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in some very, very difficult conditions. And
do you think, yeah. Lieutenant Colonel, before you go, is this inevitable in war?
Well, unfortunately,
does it have to be inevitable?
Atrocities in all wars, but it goes back to the importance of leadership again and good training, and you've got to work to minimize them, especially in a counterinsurgency war where the legitimacy of your efforts is will determine whether you win or lose, and your acceptance by the local population that you are the legitimate government. You've got to do things under the rule of law. You've got to do things the right way. It's not a fair fight. The insurgent can do a lot, get away with doing a lot of things that the counterinsurgent cannot, and that's the nature of that kind of war, and it's why insurgents fight that kind of war.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yes, ma'am.
Conrad Crane is a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and Director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute at the Army War College. We spoke to him from his office in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. And if you'd like to send us an email, the address is totn@npr.org. And I'd like to read an email here. It says, from Jean in Salt Lake City, has anyone taken a look at the lives of those who get away with these war crimes? Is there an increased incidence of violent crime in their history after Vietnam compared to other vets? Let me turn to both Deborah Nelson and Michael Sala. Deborah, I know you did follow up with some of the people who were mentioned in these reports. What was your experience when you try to interview these people?
We didn't follow up in a way that where I could give you any sort of scientific answer or trend. We did look in a few cases for any sort of criminal behavior afterwards, charges, convictions, and there weren't any that we came across. But we didn't really do a thorough look and thought actually that would be an interesting study to do.
Were they surprised to have you on their doorstep or calling them up? Was it a difficult situation?
Or? Absolutely. And one thing I can say is that pretty much none of them had ever forgotten what had happened. There were a couple that said they didn't remember anything from Vietnam at all. But for the most part, most of them had thought about what happened every day of their lives. And for most of their lives, they weren't able to talk about it because those who spoke out in the 70s were criticized and not believed. And it was a painful time.
Michael Sala, just one last question for you too, and that is, I think the question in everybody's mind when they hear about this is, you know, as Lieutenant Colonel Crane just said, you know, 99% of the troops behave in an admirable way, don't commit atrocities, and so one just is always left with what is it that pushes some over the edge and not others? Is it a combination of their personalities with the circumstances of war? Is there really something the military can ultimately do to be sure it doesn't happen again?
I think that the studies that have been done that I've researched and from many of the soldiers that we've interviewed over the last 3 years, what it really comes down to, there are individuals who can clearly cross the line of warfare and clearly will inevitably target civilians. Much of it depends on the leadership of those particular units to which they're serving. My biggest concern right now, in alluding to what the Lieutenant Colonel said, was that these Vietnam, they served one tour. It was usually a year. They had the option of returning for another one. In Iraq, they're staying longer than a year. They're being sometimes brought back for a very short period of rest, then they're sent back again. That frustration level and that level of fatigue and hostilities are increasing. And so my biggest concern is, are they going to be able to keep these kinds of units from clearly doing things they shouldn't be doing out in combat situations, the more and the longer they're out there, the more thin-stretched we are. And that's my biggest concern.
Michael, thanks so much for being with us. Michael Sala is the investigations editor for the Miami Herald and co-author of Tiger Force. Deborah Nelson is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.